Welcome to the second plenary of the conference. My name is Andrea Flack, and I'm very happy to introduce today my former PhD supervisor, Dora Biro, who works on social living and social organization in animals. She studies two very different systems. She examines group decision making and social learning in the context of navigation of homing pigeons and the emergence and maintenance of culture in wild chimpanzees. Dora received her PhD at the University of Oxford. She went afterwards for a postdoctoral fellowship to the Primate Research Institute of Kyoto University, Japan. Returned to Oxford afterwards as a Royal Society University Research Fellow, and in 2013 she became Associate Professor in Animal Behavior at the Department of Zoology at Oxford. And just a few days ago she became a full professor at the Department of Animal Behavior, Department of Zoology, and I'm very much looking forward to your talk.
Thank you. Okay, is the sound good on this? Yeah? Thank you. Okay, so, thanks very much, and a huge thank you to the organizers for inviting me to give this plenary. It's a very big honor. It's lovely to be in Konstanz for the first time, and it's really nice to catch up with new and old friends and collaborators, so I'm really grateful for this invitation. Okay, so what I'll be doing in this talk today is to try and link together two areas of behavioral biology that I think have remained fairly disparate to date. So one of these is collective action or collective cognition, and the second one is the emergence of cultural phenomena in animal groups. Okay. So animal collectives come in many shapes and sizes, and from an evolutionary point of view, there's of course many different multifaceted adaptive reasons for why they exist, from things like thermoregulatory and energetic benefits through anti-predatory benefits through to gaining information up to the kind of opportunities for cooperation. But an important and probably also quite trivial point is that while it's easy to see collectives like these as sort of relatively homogeneous things, that's not a biological reality, because in these groups, not everyone is equal. Some individuals will know different things, some will have different preferences, they will want different things, and so on. And so these differences then give rise to multiple different challenges and opportunities that come with living in groups. Animals have to make decisions together, even if different individuals have different preferences. They have to resolve this kind of conflict. They have to be able to handle both collaborative and competitive interactions with their group mates. They have also the opportunity to transmit knowledge and skills from less to more experienced group members, which is a phenomenon that can ultimately lead to culture. And I've been working on three different research streams that deal with the consequences of these kinds of inter-individual differences, and these are in the domains of spatial, symbolic, and physical cognition, basically looking at how inter-individual differences shape these different phenomena. But so in this talk, what I want to do is to make the link between this thing here, collective decision-making and culture, by linking together the spatial cognitive and physical cognitive aspects of the kinds of things that I've been doing. Okay, so when we say culture, at least colloquially, we tend to think of these kinds of things, sort of the grand sum of human knowledge and achievement. We think of art, of science, of literature, of music, and so on. But of course, for us behavioral biologists, culture can and should mean something a bit more specific, a bit more technical. And there's lots of definitions, but we can essentially break them down into three components. So first of all, we are dealing with behaviors that are transmitted through some form of social learning that is not genetically. Second, these behaviors are shared by many members of the group and will often also vary between groups. And third, that these behaviors should show some degree of permanence over time. And the kinds of knowledge and skills that are passed on can be can range from anything like foraging skills, foraging techniques, to communicative signals, to travel routes. And there's now lots of examples from a huge variety of species for these kinds of phenomena. And so the key cultural processes are these. First of all, innovation, which introduces novel behaviors into a population. Within group diffusion, which fixes these innovations in the population. And between group transmission, which allows adjacent groups to to adopt similar cultural practices through migration. And to study cultural processes in the wild is not an easy task, but the site that I've been working at with collaborators from Kyoto University has a unique field experimental setup. It's a natural clearing in the forest where we can do things that aren't normally possible to do in the wild. So for example, we can provide this tool-using wild chimpanzee community with various experimental objects. We can give them stones of various shapes and sizes. We can give them nuts that they're familiar or unfamiliar with. Why nuts and stones, I'll explain in a minute. And we can observe tool use and interactions between individuals from close range. And we can even video record all of these observations for further analysis later. And we can do this over many consecutive days, months, weeks, and even years. Okay, so this is what the behavior that I'm interested in looks like. It's the cracking of hard-shelled nuts with a pair of stones as hammer and anvil. And you see you have to be sort of quite precise in how you pick out your tools, where you place the nut on your anvil, what the forces that you hit the nut with, and so on. So there's a very specific kind of spatio-temporal sequence to this behavior. And then, so the chief reason why a behavior like this is thought to be cultural among wild chimpanzees is that it shows regional variation across Africa. So nutcracking like this is only has only been found in wild chimpanzee communities in West Africa. It seems to be completely absent from East Africa. And that's despite the fact that nuts and stones are available to East African chimpanzees as well. And so the sort of story in a nutshell would go something like this, that this is a behavior that was invented by one or a few individuals somewhere in West Africa. It diffused and was transmitted through migration to adjacent communities, but it hasn't made it as far as East Africa yet. It hasn't been invented there. And there's lots of, you know, kind of more subtle elements to this story, but I just sort of gave you a sort of cartoon version of it. And the learning, the way that the behavior is thought to spread is that the inventors or the individuals who already perform the behavior serve as models for naive learners who then acquire the behavior by watching these conspecifics. So the information goes from goes in one direction from model to observer. And now we can really drive forward our understanding of how a behavior like this is transmitted through collectives using large data sets like the decades-long video archive from our field site. And currently we're collaborating with some computer vision researchers in Oxford who are using machine learning algorithms to detect and identify individuals in these the four decades long video archive that we have, from which we can then extract things like social networks, so which individuals tend to occur with which other ones when they're not cracking, who's closest to whom, and so on, which gives us a nice outline of what the transmission channels for the behavior might be over the years. And so, in fact, we can then analyze quantitatively some of those key components of culture that I mentioned using the experiment where we introduce novel species of nuts into the community. So, for example, we've seen that innovations, so cracking novel species of nuts in this case, which are the which is the component of culture that introduces new behaviors into a group's repertoire, are more likely to originate with juveniles and with juveniles than they are with adult individuals who tend to be kind of more conservative. Then when individuals watch other individuals perform new behaviors, they tend to direct their observations towards individuals who are older or are in the same age group as themselves, not really towards younger ones. So that means that these innovations will initially spread among young individuals within the same age group or down to even younger individuals, but not upwards to adults. So there'll be a sort of time lag in adopting a new behavior at the group level. Then we've also seen that a single immigrant adult can speed up the spread of a behavior because if she performs, so if an adult performs what is effectively a new behavior for the group, then most others will pay attention and the behavior will spread much more quickly, as we saw in the introduction of one particular species of nut in these experiments. So immigrants are important. Okay, so at this point, I want to introduce two new concepts. So the first of these is an extension of the culture concept called cumulative culture, and that's something that's currently and has for quite a while been debated as the thing that might be unique about human culture. So cumulative culture is the capacity to accumulate increasingly better solutions and designs over time, for example, in technology. Essentially, in human technological evolution, innovations continually build on previous innovations until we end up with things that no individual could invent on their own in a single lifetime, like you see that in that paradigmatic quote. And the idea is that we are surrounded by things like this. You know, we have smartphones and 3D printers and the moon rover and so on. And clearly these are things that only thousands or even millions of years of technological knowledge accumulation could have produced, and that there's really nothing like this that we can think of in non-humans. And the reason why that's thought to be the case is that is because cumulative culture, if we see it or conceptualize it in this way, seems to necessitate a unique constellation of complex cognitive skills, including things like teaching, language, pro-sociality, imitation, and so on. But I would suggest that maybe this limits our perspective on what cumulative culture is or what it might be, and that we could enhance this perspective through creating a kind of interface between collective action and cultural transmission, specifically by looking for these kinds of phenomena in previously overlooked contexts, such as the generation and transmission of travel routes in collectively traveling species. And I'll explain this a bit more clearly when I go through the next next set of experiments. But first of all, the second concept I also wanted to introduce was to do with dissecting what the meaning of social transmission really is. So we can deconstruct this idea a little bit and think about the ways in which we can innovate and learn new things, okay? So here's an example. We're all familiar with the experience of driving or walking through a new environment to a new destination, where through the experience of taking a specific route, we learn about landmarks and the kind of twists and turns of the route. So that's kind of individual level learning. On the other hand, imagine that you're a passenger in a car and you're being driven to a destination, and by doing so, you're being exposed to the knowledge of the driver, and you can assimilate the same information. So that would be social learning. Knowledge passes in one direction. It's generated by the knowledgeable driver, and it passes through the naive passenger. But then there's another scenario in collective navigation, so in animals that navigate collectively. Imagine that not only the driver, but also the passenger is able to operate the steering wheel. Okay, so it's every driver's worst nightmare. But basically, the route that then emerges out of this interaction is something that sort of averages out what either of them wants to do, and hence it affects what it is that they learn, the information that they learn. So the information that they learn is then generated through their interaction. It's not coming from either one or the other, it's coming from the kind of joint outcome of both of them contributing to solving this task. So that's That's what I would refer to as collective learning, and I think that's what unites the kind of wisdom of the crowd, or collective cognition, collective decision making, with cultural transmission. So it's a way of generating new information, way of generating innovations that I think has been kind of overlooked in studies of how culture might emerge. Okay, so do we see cumulative culture in chimpanzee tool use? So one interesting thing, potentially, that could be an example, that one interesting thing we've seen is that when chimpanzees crack nuts with an anvil that doesn't have a sort of nice level upper surface, so when you put a nut on it, it rolls off, then they occasionally insert another stone, a third stone underneath it called a wedge, which sort of stabilizes the upper surface. So it's a sort of elaboration on the original hammer and anvil setup. But it is a very rare behavior. We're never quite sure whether it's done deliberately or accidentally. But if it is, then the idea would be that this is an innovation that builds upon the group's existing knowledge to crack nuts. So it's not quite the Moon Rover, but having the capacity for innovations like this, for building on the knowledge of inventions made by sort of your ancestors, your past generations, is what's important. Okay, but so what next? Could chimpanzees do better than this? And why don't they, if they don't? So are there other contexts that may be more promising for us to look at? Okay, so what does it take for cumulative culture to emerge? And I want to tell you quickly about an experiment that inspired our study, the one that I'm going to tell you about next. So this is a classic laboratory study of a laboratory test of cumulative culture in humans. So what Caldwell and Millen did here was they instructed human participants to build towers out of spaghetti and plasticine, as tall a tower as they could build. So that was the instructions. But they didn't give everyone the chance to work on this task at once. But what they did was they allowed them to do so in batches. So first, they had three people who built a tower, and then they added in a four person after 2.5 minutes, and then they had to start again, so they built another tower. Then after another 2.5 minutes, they took out one of the original individuals and added in a new one, a naive one, and again they built a tower, and so on and so on. So basically this sort of simulates demographic turnover in a population, right? You have births and deaths, and you get this kind of transmission chain through which knowledge and skills can pass. And what was interesting in the results was that the height of the towers that these so-called micro-societies were able to build increased as you progress in the chain. So the later on in the chain they were, the higher the tower was that they were able to build. So that suggested that knowledge and skills were accumulating in these societies as the generations progressed. So can we then translate this design to a different context in which interactions between individuals might generate increasingly better solutions to a problem? And our study system for this was homing pigeons, where our typical experiment would involve fitting miniature GPS devices to the backs of pigeons and then taking them out to remote release sites, releasing them, and essentially getting them to solve particular navigational tasks, either individually or in groups. And so through this work, which was done by a very large number of people over the years, so through this work, we know that individual pigeons adopt idiosyncratic routes home that they remain extremely faithful to. So these, for example, are 9 different birds, all of them flying home down here to the same release point up here. And what you see is that every single one of them has a different route. So this is the kind of the idea of this idiosyncrasy in route choice. So this is what these are the routes that each of those pigeons kind of thinks is a reasonable solution to that particular navigational task of getting home. Okay, so that's the background. But then we became interested in whether these routes really can be thought of effectively as innovations or pieces of information that can potentially be transmitted from one individual to another. So we ran a standard social learning study. We paired a naive individual with a knowledgeable one. We let them fly together repeatedly, and then looked at whether the observer at the end of that experiment came to adopt the same route that the demonstrator had flown. So the observer was naive initially, it didn't have a route that it knew. And the answer to the outcome of this experiment was that the observer did learn the route, but that also there was more to this story than that. It wasn't simply that the observer, the learner followed and that it learned the route that it was being demonstrated to it, so it wasn't merely a passenger, but actually it became an active participant in the process, okay? So what you see here is how close to the beeline the demonstrator bird is flying, so closer to the beeline meaning it's a better route. So this is how close it's flying to that beeline over its training period, and you see that up to a certain point it keeps increasing, but then it sort of plateaus out. So it reaches a point beyond which it is unable to improve on its own. It's a sort of individual limit, a constraint on how good it's going to get individually. But then when you add in this naive observer, what you see is that the efficiency of the route, so how close to the beeline it is, begins to drop once again. So effectively, you've added in another ped tasked with solving this task, and together through a sort of wisdom of the crowd, or a crowd of two in this case, they're able to improve beyond what a single individual is capable of. And then together they learn that route and maintain that route from then onwards. So that would be an example of collective learning, when information that is learned in a social context is actually generated and can only be generated through the interactions of multiple individuals. And it happens to be better than what a single individual can generate. So then we ran that spaghetti tower-like transmission chain study with pigeons. This is work by Takao Sasaki, who was a postdoc in my group at the time. And what he did was he also created micro-societies, so he would pair up two birds, he'd let them fly together 12 times, then he'd remove one of the individuals and add in a naive new one, let them fly together 12 times, again remove one of the old individuals and add in a new one, let them fly together 12 times, and so on and so on. And he ran a total of five successive generations in 10 replicates, 10 independent chains. And at the same time, he also ran two different types of control. One was a solo bird, so it's just a single bird flying as many times as the total number of releases in the transmission chain condition, and also a pair control condition in which we have a pair of pigeons flying again 60 times, so as many times as in the experimental chains, but without any generational turnover. Okay? So no membership turnover, sorry. Okay, so then the results were really nice. So this is on the y-axis, route efficiency. So it's again a measure of how good the route is that these birds were able to take as a function of where in the kind of generational chain we are. And actually, we're only really interested in the final performance of each generation. So essentially, the kind of height of the spaghetti tower that they were able to build. And then if we just plot those, we see that whilst the efficiency of the homing route is still increasing in our experiment, also the transmission chain condition, it's sort of plateaued out in the solo and pair condition. So they've stopped getting any better after even the first 12 releases, whereas in the experimental group, they're still getting better and better with every generation. And it's not a massive difference, but it is significant by the final two generations. So here, I think we have a case where this kind of collective or collaborative problem solving coupled with learning during collective action can actually lead to better solutions to collective problems. And not only that, but these solutions get retained in groups over successive generations. And if you accept that this is something like cumulative culture, then it's nice because it suggests that you don't need those kind of sophisticated cognitive skills that I mentioned earlier, the ones that have been suggested for humans, to have this kind of progressive improvement in solutions to problems over generations. But what it does show, I think, is that indeed it might be fruitful to start looking for these kinds of cumulative effects in contexts where people haven't done so in the past. And our pigeon study looked at homing routes, but it was in an experimental context. So I was really excited to see this paper come out just last year on ungulate migrations, which sort of validates this idea in a natural context. And what this paper showed was that over decades, translocated populations of bighorn sheep and moose appeared to get increasingly good at tracking the seasonal emergence of vegetation or food across space. So the idea is that across generations, they're building up knowledge of where the food is, and this knowledge is getting passed down and built upon by future generations. So it's a really nice example, I think, of people starting to look for this cumulative cultural effects in new contexts. And incidentally, it also raises lots of interesting points about conservation. So in that, you know, conservation is not just about preserving species, but it's also about allowing them to preserve the kind of the knowledge that has built up over, that has built up in populations over many decades or many generations. Okay, so then that brings me to the question that I want to address in the last few minutes of my talk, which is whether we can be a bit more precise about what constitutes the group's knowledge when it comes to travel routes. And so far, we've deduced learning and transmission of knowledge by looking at the structure of routes. But can we actually say something more precise about what it is that individuals are learning and how they're acquiring that information? And to look into that question, we've been using some new technology that was developed thanks to some amazing efforts by Fumihiro Kano. These are head-mounted sensors that are attached to the pigeons' heads through a custom-made little wire mask, which the head-mounted sensor gives us information about head movements in three axes, yaw, roll, and pitch. And I'll explain why head movements give us such nice information about visual attention, but it's probably easiest if I do that by showing you a video. So here are some, here's a flock of pigeons that have been fitted with head-mounted cameras in this case, not the head-mounted sensors. And they're being released at a location about 2 kilometers from home in this case. And you see, well, there's lots of things you see. For example, you see just how complex the visual landscape is that these birds are navigating through, how they're having to sort of reconcile looking at the landscape with looking at their flock mates, and so on. But the important thing I want to draw your attention to here are these kind of quick, jerky movements of the camera. I think it's quite easy to see. So those are saccadic head movements, which in birds who have eyes that are pretty much fixed in their head correspond to eye saccades in primates. So they're sort of signatures of the birds shifting their attention. So they're fixating on something, and then they quickly turn their head to fixate on something else. So that's the kind of thing that gives us really interesting information about what they're looking at, how they're basically deploying their attention when they're flying over complex landscapes and with, thank you, Andrea, and also together with their flock mates. Okay, so we can get lots of meaningful data out of these head saccadic movements. So this is a visualization of the head movements of a single bird flying on its own. You can see the route that it's taking at the same time. And then we can go even deeper. These are the kinds of traces that we get from the sensor, where if you combine the measurements at the top, you get this head angular velocity measure, where each of those spikes basically corresponds to one of these saccadic shifts in attention. And these saccades vary in frequency and they vary in amplitude. We can also do the same thing for pairs of birds. So this is now two birds flying together and the simultaneous recording of their head movements. And so one of the things we see here, for example, is that when we compare head movements between birds flying solo with birds flying in a pair, we see that the overall head movements are actually reduced in a pair, which is a very interesting finding. And indeed, these summary statistics confirm this. So both saccade frequency and saccade amplitude seem to drop significantly when birds are flying in a pair. And so we're hypothesizing that there might be three potential reasons, not necessarily mutually exclusive reasons for this. It could be that in pairs, the many eyes principle means that they scan the environment less in vigilance for predators. So it could be this kind of sharing the task of vigilance among them. They could also be sharing the navigational task among them. So each individual has to scan less of the landscape as they're flying along. Or it could be something more basic to do with coordinating a paired flight, where actually we have some follow-up data from Lucy Taylor's work there on how birds, if they do want to fly and coordinate with a partner, they need to keep their heads more stable in order to maintain that that close individual in focus. Okay, so I mean, at least a third of these we think is likely to be the case, but like I said, they're not mutually exclusive, so it could be that one or the other of those factors also comes into play. And then there's interesting extensions, of course, of this. We have data from larger flocks as well, where we will also be able to look at variation in individual variation in visual attention. So, for example, how does an individual's leadership rank within a flock correlate with how much attention it pays to the landscape versus its flock mates, and so on? Yeah. Okay. 0 minutes. I'm sorry. Okay, I think I'll just skip through this. This is actually ongoing work. We're trying to see if we can actually pin down what it is in the environment that birds are looking at, but that's complicated because they actually have two foveas per eye, so areas of high visual acuity. But one way in which we're trying to do this, or actually James Walker, a previous PhD student, is trying to do this, is to project out from the foveas as the bird is flying along at the moment where the head saccades occur, and then we can superimpose lots of these roots and lots of these saccades onto the landscape with the idea that where these kinds of projections intersect are, that's where the landmarks of interest are found. So this is just one image from his ongoing work. We can see that we get these hotspots in the landscape, which we can then correlate or try to correlate with what's actually underneath them. So for example, they might, in that case here, the temporal fovea, they congregate over a village. When it's the fovea looking out straight ahead, then they tend to congregate on the root, which sort of makes sense. Okay, so, sorry, I'm nearly done. I think this is my penultimate slide. So these are just thoughts because this is still some ongoing work. But I think this kind of data really gives us a nice novel window, not only onto visual attention, but also how spatial knowledge builds up within groups. So for example, we can ask whether the same landscape features are attended to by different flock members, or do different individuals attend to different things? So basically, does the knowledge of a root mean the same or different things for different individuals? We can also ask how flock members distribute their attention between flock mates and landscape features. Are there individual differences in this? Do some attend more to the landscape? And are they then the ones who also correspond to who the leaders are? And do others pay more attention to flock mates? And then also, are there perhaps keystone individuals who hold more of the group's collective knowledge than others, and therefore whose kind of persistence in the group is also key to the survival of that knowledge within the group? Okay, very last slide. To finish, I just want to sum up this framework that I was suggesting for the interface between collective action and cognition and culture. So first of all, we know that collective intelligence produces superior solutions to individual cognition, individual solutions, but I'd argue that if individuals can learn also from these experiences of acting collectively with others, which is different from social learning where information flows just one way, then the knowledge here can be created from the interactions between individuals and learned collectively. Then that knowledge could feed back into making decisions next time the group faces a similar decision-making scenario. And then through this feedback, we can give collective behavior a kind of time depth where rather than it being a one-off process, it's a process that has a history upon which its current state is contingent. And then that gives us a range of different things, new and existing processes that I think are worthy of study, like collective rather than individual innovation, collective learning, culture, cumulative collective intelligence, and then the build-up of all of these towards cumulative culture. Thank you. Sorry, I overran.
Then we have 5 minutes for questions.
Thank you very much. That was very impressive. Out of your work and many others, we know that there's quite a lot of variation among individuals. How do you correct for that in your pairwise experiments? So when you add and take out one animal out of the pair, each one is different.
Right. So that's a really good question. And actually, in the original study, this was done randomly. So we picked, you know, subjects from our subject pool at random, so there was no kind of systematic way in which we varied what the effectively, because what you're doing when you're adding in a new individual is that you're adding in noise to the system, right? It's a stable system, and then you inject it with some noise, and you see what that noise does to, it can be bad or good noise, and the idea is that the individuals can filter out the bad noise, keep the good noise, and that's what allows the routes to improve when this noise is injected. But I think what your question is getting at is to do with varying, with actually knowing something about, you know, it's not just random noise you're adding. You could be adding noise of a certain magnitude. So for example, there might be birds that are particularly dominant, and they're much more likely to contribute a lot to that to the collective route. There might be some that are more kind of demure, and they, you know, hardly contribute anything. So actually, that is one of the things that that we're thinking about, is to run these experiments, but at the same time systematically vary something about that noise that is being added. So that can be, yeah, that can be, you know, anything from, you know, things like personality we have, or more like boldness. So we can quantify boldness in individuals. We can look at, you know, ones that tend to be more exploratory rather than conservative, and see how that affects the collective outcome.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for that great talk. So I had a question about tool use. Like, there's this theory about handedness evolving due to imitation and teaching of tool use. Is there any evidence for that? Do you see some groups having more right-handers or something like that?
Yeah, that's a really nice question too. So, So this particular group of chimps that we work with, they have perfect handedness when it comes to hammering at the individual level. So a given individual will always use their right hand or their left hand for hammering. When they do other tool use behaviors, that's less clear. And one of the reasons we think is because this is one of the most complex forms of tool use. You really have to coordinate your actions very well. So it's a very difficult task, and potentially lateralization in this way helps them, you know, what is necessary. But in terms of the, one of the interesting patterns that we see is that there's no clear correspondence between mother and offspring in handedness. So a right-handed mother might have a right-handed or a left-handed offspring. But what there is almost perfect correspondence among siblings. So, you know, you'll have the same handedness as your sibling, brother or sister, but not necessarily the same as your mom. And one of the explanations we think for that is that it's not the fact that it's learned by imitation. So, you know, if I see my mom hammering with the right hand, I use right hand as well. But something else about the learning environment that the mother provides that then channels all of her offspring to be left or right-handed. So, for example, if you remember in that video, there's a little kid sitting on the mom's lap as she is hammering, and it could be something like, you know, if she tends to hold the infant on the right, then it's the left hand of that infant that's free to start handing objects. So I think certainly there's something about the social environment that can shape laterality and handedness, but it's not through imitation as such. No.
Thank you for the great talk. I'm here. For the home flying pigeon release, I have a question, and you saw that the guys where you switched the individuals, so you did this collective learning, they were first less efficient, and then they got better. But I wonder, so it is clear the one needs to learn, and therefore they need to optimize, but at the same time, I think they also scan, try out more different paths, and I was wondering if you tried to introduce noise in the release point, so make it actually not exactly the same release point, and then maybe they would even more outperform the individuals, which would always go for this, try the same route, and so this noise could be a good optimization thing.
That's a really nice idea, and I think you picked up on exactly one of the, I didn't even say it, but that's exactly one of the most interesting points in that experiment, is that they do that you do see this drop initially when you add in the new individual, and that's this noise that I was talking about. So I'm not sure I quite caught the end of your question. So you're suggesting changing the release point to kind of
introduce noise, and then they might be even outperform the solo release.
Yeah, right. Because you're forcing them to. Yeah, I see what you mean. So you're forcing them to be noisy, effectively, and explore rather than just go with what they're comfortable with. Yeah. No, we haven't done that, but yeah, that's a nice idea. And that could work at the individual level too, right? Because it's all about just knocking someone out of their comfort zone in order to, to lead to improvements. Yeah.
So, hi.
Hi, Lucy.
So you emphasized that the importance of demographic turnover for the accumulation of improvements in the pigeon groups. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit to whether this is generational turnover or turnover within generations, for example, migration or fission-fusion dynamics within groups, and whether you think that there's any difference between those two, or what the implications would be of those two differences.
Yeah. So that's exactly the kinds of lines that we're thinking along now, and experiments are running right now to try and look at this. So basically, So you could argue that what I call generational turnover, it's not really the turnover that matters. It's just the reshuffling of heads, right? So rather than have, 10 individuals in solving the task in pairs, you could have all 10 individuals solving it at the same time, or 5 and 5, and then reshuffling, between them. So I don't know which of those is the thing that's causing the improvement, whether it's just, reshuffling opinions, and you could, rather than take individuals out permanently, you could put them back in later on into the chain to see if, just by virtue of having shaken up the system and reshuffled who interacts with whom, and therefore whose kind of opinions are integrated at any given point in the process, you get the same effect as this, what we call demographic turnover, so having completely naive individuals come in at each transition event. I don't know if I quite answered your question, but I'm happy to chat to you afterwards.
Okay, thank you very much, Dora, for this great talk.
Thank you.